the first time I came back when I was single, I came back and because of the excessive amount of porn that I'd watched, I thought that I myself could reenact a porn star's lifestyle.
Really?
Which, lo and behold, I could not. So it was one of those things. And then after my second trip, after being wounded when I came back, I was a bit more, I was in a depressed state. I had a head injury. I had a stutter. I just had a really life-threatening experience. So when I came back, I had absolutely no sex drive whatsoever. It wasn't even on the priority of list of things I even wanted to do.
The hookup. Love and f***ing on Triple J.
Warning, sex and adult themes.
Serving in a war is one of the most testing and potentially traumatic experiences a person could possibly go through. So we thought we'd take a look at what war does to the relationships and sex lives of our young veterans. Joining us is Chris May. He's the co-founder of Young Veterans, a group that aims to empower young vets. Also joining us is Dr. Stephanie Hodson, who works for the Department of Veterans Affairs as the National Manager of the Veterans and Veterans Family Counselling Service. Dr. Hodson has worked for 25 years in military mental health and is a colonel in the Army Reserve and is herself an Australian Defence Force veteran. Also with us is Dr. Christopher Fox. He's a psychosexual and relationships therapist. Chris, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So where did you serve and what did you do while you were in the Army?
So I served in two tours in Afghanistan, one in 2009 and the second one in 2011. My job was cavalry, so armoured vehicles, providing overwatch for infantry moving through the green zones of Afghanistan. And on my second tour, I was actually wounded in action by a roadside bomb and diagnosed with traumatic brain injury, PTSD, anxiety, depression. In 2012, I attempted my own life, to take my own life. And then coming back from that, went through pretty intensive trauma therapy and it made it all through it. And now I help other people that are in a position that I was.
Yeah, and so I imagine your experience is really what's driving you to you know, help young vets like yourself to not feel so isolated when they come home.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of those things, like I've lived it, and seeing some of the signs in some of my own friends, having friends of mine, you know, commit suicide, going on with that, there's so many things we're all struggling with, and just normal reintegration and just becoming, you know, a normal civvy again is the hardest process.
Yeah, absolutely. So what made you want to join the Army in the first place?
The biggest reason for me to join the Army was that I got bullied in high school. I got bullied in primary school, bullied in high school, and I thought, I've had a gutful of this. I'm going to go join the Army and make a difference. And I left at the end of year 10 and joined the Army at the age of 17, trying to join to be an apprentice. Yeah, I tried to join as an apprentice and pretty much got told, you know, that's not on. So I picked a job in Armoured Corps driving armoured vehicles. So before I could actually drive myself around in my car on my P-plates, I actually had the license to drive a 13.5-ton armoured vehicle.
What did that feel like as a 17-year-old?
Oh, pretty exhilarating. You know, you're driving around a couple million-dollar vehicle. That's worth, you know, with a crew of three, and, you know, just the teamwork aspect of it and the job was just exhilarating. It was that sense of adventure that this you know, soldiers felt 100 years ago. Same thing. You knew this was the start of a big journey, and you never know what it was going to take you, but you kind of hoped that it was going to take you around the world. So,
and that must
and then
have
eventually
been,
did.
And that must have been pretty empowering, as you know, a 17-year-old kid who's been bullied.
Yeah, it was a double-edged sword, though.
Yeah.
So it did. It really empowered me a bit. But then I came back home to see my friends and family, and that's when the attitudes changed. That's when you know, I thought I'd matured a bit more. Probably went a bit too far and got a bit arrogant, and then you know, went overseas and came back, and then attitudes and perceptions and, you know, personal relationships, family relationships, everything just went absolutely down the gurgler.
So were you in a relationship when you left?
On my first tour, I wasn't. I went over as 19-year-old, came back 20-year-old, single, and just, you know, kept on charging as a young soldier did. And then when I went over on my second trip, I actually broke it off literally weeks before I deployed, kind of like a, I don't need this, this is extra weight, and I cut it away, and then came back overseas after being wounded and then started a new relationship.
And so what was it like adjusting back to regular life when you came back from both those tours?
It was difficult. It was really hard. You come back, and the biggest concern of normal society is the price of bread and butter, or who won the footy on the weekend. Not knowing that on the other side of the world there are people dying for literally minuscule events, and it's never publicised. And soldiers struggle with that because you come back and you've seen things over there, and no one cares. And that's where the attitude comes from. It's kind of nobody understands, nobody gets it, and so that's where the anger comes in. Nobody cares about what I did over there, so out of fear they start to get angry, and that's where we start to see a lot of the aggression issues as well.
Yeah, it must feel quite isolating. So when did you realise that you had post-traumatic stress disorder?
Probably the key thing for me was when I climbed over the balcony and looked down at the ground from 10 stories up, and I stared at the ground, and I did that, and I thought, it'd be better off not being on this earth right about now. And then the first thing I could think of was my girlfriend. And I thought, no, she's going to call me tonight, because she was actually deployed in Afghanistan at the time. And we called each other every night, and she was going to call me, and I knew that she was going to call that night. So I thought, climb back over, and I lied in the balcony, and I cried and had a moment. And that's when I called up VVCS for the first time and said, I've got an issue.
That's fantastic that you were able to seek help. What was the organisation that you called?
It was the Veterans and Veterans Families Counselling Service, VVCS, which is a counselling service for veterans and their families as well. So the partners and the children as well can get free counselling.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, while you were over there, did you feel yourself cutting off emotionally, or did it only kind of just start to all come to the surface when you got back?
It was before. So before I left, mm-hmm. started cutting off emotionally. Whilst I was over there, kept cutting off more people. I kept cutting people out of my life completely. And then coming back, the only people that I really had were the people that I just spent 9 months with in a war zone. Mm-hmm. So I turned around to people like my own mother. She came back to see me at the airport, and I turned around to mum and said, I'm going into town with these guys because they're my family now.
Oh, wow.
And I went into town and hit the pubs with the boys, and not realising at that time I'd just literally broken my mother's heart. And that was hard, realising that years later and apologising for that. But, you get to the point where you literally start to deny your own family.
And I've just got the number here for the Veterans and Veterans Family Counselling Service. If this has brought up feelings for you and you need to talk to someone about it, that number's 1-800-011-046. And there are people there available for you 24 hours a day. Coming up, we're going to be talking about what it's like when you're deployed. Do you go without sex for the whole time, and how does it affect the people that you've left behind? And yeah, we're going to be talking about what it's like over there for young vets. Stay with us. And joining me is Dr. Stephanie Hodson via Skype. She works for the Department of Veterans Affairs and as the National Manager of the Veterans and Veterans Families Counselling Service. Dr. Hodson has worked for 25 years in military mental health and is a colonel in the Army Reserve and is herself an Australian Defence Force veteran. Dr. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Hannah.
And also with us is Dr. Christopher Fox, who is a psychosexual and relationships therapist. Dr. Fox, thank you.
Good evening. Thank you.
And Chris, who is a veteran that you heard from a little earlier. Chris, when you're over there, when you're deployed, how do you get by with, I guess, your sexuality? I mean, does anyone have sex?
There are pretty strict rules on fraternisation, especially between Australian defence personnel and other coalition forces as well. But it does still happen. I'm not going to lie. People still have it. There are men and women over there. It has happened before. But in saying that, most of the guys, when you've got a battle group of 1,200 blokes, the vast majority of them just resort to masturbation at excessive levels.
Oh, what's an excessive amount?
If you're out on patrol, you're not doing it. You're probably more focused on trying to keep your own life and patrolling and looking for the enemy. But when you're back in the main base, you see guys walking around with their laptops, going into toilets or going into the shower blocks, and they'll just stay in there for a couple of hours, have a long, long shower and go through all the water.
Hours?
Yeah, there'd be. I know one guy that did it. He'd literally disappear for a few hours at a time. Most blokes, it would just be a quick, go down to the porta potties or whatever the case may be, and just get it out of the way and go back to work.
So, Dr. Fox, is This sounds like a pretty excessive, you know, case of masturbation over there. Could that, in what ways could that affect a person?
I'm going to say masturbating for hours is a pretty excessive case of masturbation, no matter where you are under any condition.
Yeah.
Excessive masturbation, I mean, first and foremost, I'm not going to problematise masturbation, I think, and the situation that, that we're talking about. It's about how masturbation's being used and, you know, it's being used to soothe, to escape. Is it accessible at hours? Yes. But then it depends on how it impacts on function, whether that's sexual function or general life function. You know, a 19-year-old guy masturbating twice a day, you know, for half an hour at a time, it may not necessarily have a big impact on their lives, but a 38-year-old or a 40-year-old guy masturbating twice a day for half an hour at a time, it's going to impact on the function of their lives. So, you know, I think it varies between people, but it's about why people are masturbating and yeah, what they're doing with it.
Chris, do you think,
how they're doing it.
Chris, do you think people used it as a form of escapism when they were deployed overseas?
I'd say it's probably just more to pass the time.
Yeah.
It was a very much a boredom thing. You know, there was only so many movies you can watch. If you had a couple of days off and you were standing down, once the weapons are cleaned and you've gone through the job of resetting up for your next task, you'd get a day off and, you know, you'd watch a movie and then the guys would just, that's enough, they're done, and they'd go. And that was the... That was how they pretty much passed the time.
Dr. Hodson, why are relationships in combat discouraged?
The impact on the team. So basically what you want to do is keep a pretty cohesive team. And as you can imagine, if you're deployed for 8 months and someone actually is in a relationship and it falls apart, that can have a massive impact on your cohesion of your whole team. So the idea, any sort of too intimate relationship, which would impact the ability of the whole team to function, is always frowned upon.
And we've spoken a little bit about guys masturbating while they're deployed. For women serving, it's a very different story. How do they cope in such a male-dominated environment?
You still do have a lot of contact back with home. I think one of the challenges actually of being on deployment is, in fact, the amount of contact now with modern technology. You can be talking to your partners and talking to your fiancé or talking to your spouse back home. Comes with its own level of frustration. But I suppose at the end of the day, you know, one of the things to remember is it's typically only 4 months. In the 8 months, service personnel actually get a break in the middle. Many of those would actually spend that break by going to Europe and catching up with their partner maybe for a week. And some people would come the whole trip home to Australia and spend a week back at home. Being in the Defence Force, you get very used to having periods away from each other. So couples that survive in the Defence Force are couples who are pretty good at sort of balancing that act of actually spending time together and then time away.
And Chris, you're talking about guys masturbating in the cubicles while you're over there. That must be a pretty gnarly environment to do it in. I mean, I imagine they're not the cleanest. It's not the cleanest, freshest smelling place to be doing that.
No, they're definitely not. They used to call them the little sweat boxes just because, you know, it's a 40-degree day, middle of the day. You wouldn't stay in there for more than 5 minutes if you could. But there was actually a song. We actually had one of the Tour de Forces guys come across with the music. His name's Fred Smith, and he actually sung a song. And the Dutch had a saying that was "Nitch Swashlin op de Dixie," which was no masturbation in the toilets, because it was a problem with the Dutch at the same time. And there was actually orders written on the toilet saying "Do not masturbate in here." And he wrote a song about it. As a comical piece, and it was hilarious. But every soldier, Dutch, Australian, American, that was in that base all laughed at it because they're like, this is true. Everyone's doing it, so it was one of those things, they weren't the greatest and cleanest things in the world. And if you were, if you were there at the wrong time, the vacuum guy would come along and that would ruin your day.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Dr. Fox, being in that sort of masculine environment with, I imagine, Chris, is there a lot of porn going around, being shared around, I guess?
Yeah.
Yeah?
There's, literally within your first week of being there, there's a bloke walking around that's, the guys that are leaving country are walking away with a hard drive. And, we're in Afghanistan for 15 years, so those hard drives are pretty full up now. And guys would hand them out and be like, you're going to need this, mate. And then that would start making the rounds. And the amount of porn it was getting around just the battle group, it was ridiculous. No one was short of it.
And Dr. Fox, being in that sort of masculine environment with all that porn and little female contact, I imagine, can that have some kind of effect on guys when they return?
Of course, yeah, it can have an effect. It can impact on their arousal patterns, for want of a way of putting it. They become used to the arousal from the screen, from the porn, from the changing clips, because it wouldn't be like watching a Spider-Man movie where you watch the whole movie. You're sort of jumping from clip to clip to clip to clip and changing actors, you're changing scenes, you're changing volume. You've got all this other stimulation happening, which can impact on sexual function further down the track. You're sort of also habituating yourself to your own hand, and no other part of a body is ever necessarily going to replace that hand easily. I think it can and could very much so impact on their sex lives when they return.
And we're going to be looking at sexual dysfunction in a little bit more depth very soon on the show. But coming up next, what is it like to return from war, and how does that affect your sex lives and relationships, potentially with someone that you've left behind? That's coming up next. And joining me is Dr. Stephanie Hodson from the Veterans and Veterans Families Counselling Service, who is also a colonel in the Army Reserve and is a Defence Force veteran herself, and Chris May from Young Veterans. Chris, how difficult is it for young vets to be honest about their feelings when they get back from war?
It's almost impossible. It took me years to do it, and I know that there are a lot of people out there that still don't, won't recognise it. It's hard. You end up either losing something, you lose a relationship, you lose close friends, before you actually start slowly piece it together that it's partly you, and you've got to discuss those feelings. And there are so many organisations trying to help those people, but it's just getting them in the door. It's the hard bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Stephanie, what is PTSD and what effect does it have on young veterans?
I think the easiest way to explain, Hannah, PTSD is it is a fundamental shattering of your sense of safety in the world. Most of us here would tomorrow drive to work, and if we were driving to work and we went through a green light doing absolutely nothing wrong and someone took us out from the side, you're likely to get PTSD. The next time you get in the car, because at the moment of that crash, your brain has just learned how unsafe the world can be. Everything about that moment, the sound, the music playing on the radio, if it was a rainy day, the next time you get in your car, if that music comes on the radio, your brain turns on. So basically this hyperarousal switch, which is all about survival, turns on. It's a form of injury. Combat in itself doesn't always mean that you have that life-threatening moment that turns that switch on. But when it does happen, people then have to live with that hyper-arousal. While they're in theatre, it can actually be quite protective because that constant surveillance looking for risk can be very adaptive. But when you come home, you come back to your family, it becomes really tough.
Does theatre mean in seeing action in combat?
Yeah, so when you're actually overseas in the deployed environment, still being very aroused, looking for danger, picking up the cues, it's why your brain does it. It's actually training you to look for danger. The trouble is, as you come home, if that switch has been turned on and you go back to regular life, driving down the road in Australia, you don't have to be looking constantly for a roadside bomb. But if you've had one of those events like Chris had, you will still be looking for it, even years later, once you've got the symptoms of PTSD.
And Chris, how did that sort of manifest itself or affect your love life and relationships?
For the most part, it destroyed it. The hypervigilance stops you from doing normal activities. I remember when I came back, it was probably within the first month of me being home, I was walking with my my then partner down the road, and a car backfired and actually got in the ground. And it was like everyone I've spoken to about it kind of have a chuckle about it. We all laugh about it as we do. But at the time, it was instinctive. That's was something we did. And it freaked me out, and then it freaked her out as well. And then, the flow on effects from that was that New Year's Eve, because we got back in, would have been October, and that New Year's Eve, I broke down in tears at the at New Year's fireworks. I was just terrified of the bangs and everything, and that stopped us from doing normal things like going out and having a few drinks with friends, and it ruined the night and the amount of arguments we had because we had nights ruined because of me, and that hypervigilance was just detrimental to our relationship.
Chris, were you told about PTSD and how this, if you were affected by it, how it could affect your life before you signed up or before you were deployed?
We all knew the risks. We all know what it used to be called, you know, shell shock, battle fatigue, all the same things occur. And we've seen it throughout the ages. But when you join up, you know, it's not that's not even the first thing on your mind. The first thing on your mind is becoming a soldier. And, you know, even sailors and airmen and women, their focus is on their job. And that's what they want to be focusing on is their job. It's when you're over there, you know, in any theatre, even peacekeeping operations or, you know, even training exercises, where you're just so busy with your job, you forget those basic things. And it might be a car accident on a training exercise. It might be a mate getting killed. It might be a bomb blast. It might be seeing, you know, having to deal with death on operations. You start to really, you know, break it all down and it starts to really affect you. And even then, your focus is still your job, so you lie about it. And that's how you get through. You keep lying and you lie and you lie and you focus on your job. And, you know, the best soldiers I've seen some brilliant soldiers crumble after years of perfect work. Those guys were picking up awards and they just crumbled. And that was the saddest part is we all lied. And we still do. We still lie just to keep doing our jobs because we love it.
And yeah, that's the hardest part. It's such a catch-22 though.
Yeah, it really is, and it's I did it. You know, it was hard for me because when I came back, I got pulled away from all my mates about 4 months before. So maybe that 3 months before they returned home, and I just wanted to go back up there to Townsville and see them as they came back through the gates. I didn't get to do that, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to get back up to the unit. I'm going to get myself back to Townsville. So I fought tooth and nail. Every single doctor, every single psych, every single psych session I did, I walked in there and lied through my teeth.
Wow.
And I just said, I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm good. There was no pain in my neck. There was no pain in my head. I lied about everything. And then it all started to, you know, one doctor was skeptical and said, I don't believe you, and kept me there. And that's when my PTSD started getting worse because finally someone was treating me properly, but I didn't agree with it, so I started to get angry and start to use that aggression and start to be arrogant, and I'd start to treat other people like crap, and I started treating my partner at the time like crap. We'd just have yelling matches about nothing. That was all me. It was all me.
So, Stephanie, you've been working with young vets for years. Can you tell when they're shutting these feelings away and not dealing with them or not being truthful to you? How do you get through to them?
Hannah, I think there's a point where most people, and a little bit as Chris says, is you've got to go on a little bit of a journey, and there's a point where you don't always have to hit rock bottom, but you hit a point in your life where something tells you, I have to change. And the good news is that there is treatment. And as Chris said earlier, we do have trauma-focused treatments that are tough. They take you back to the event. And they, when I talked about turning on that hyperarousal, we do have treatments that help you actually bring that arousal back and bring it back under control. And that most of the time, once you've been through treatment, you learn the skills to actually keep it in a box. You rebuild your relationships with the people around you. And so there is hope out there. I want any young veteran listening here to realize that, you know, if you come in for treatment, the trouble is it's that trigger that gets you to treatment. Mm. We see about 15,000 young veterans every year, and half of the people we see actually are families. 7,000 of the people we see are actually the families that often sometimes come in first because the veteran's not ready to do it. So sometimes it takes the family to come in for treatment or the partner comes in. But I tell you what, so many of the blokes who do come in are there because my wife or my partner is going to leave me if I don't come do this. So sometimes it takes someone in the family or the surrounding network to sort of say to someone, hey, enough's enough. You know, Chris told his story earlier, which was really moving. You know, in himself, he said, enough's enough. But sometimes it takes that push from someone around you who can see that you've changed. One of the problems some of these young veterans have is in themselves, they can't see it. it sometimes is the mum or the dad or the best mate who says, hey, you're not the same person. We've got to get you some help.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Hookup with Hannah Riley on Triple J. Coming up, we're going to be looking at some of the more surprising ways that war affects veterans' abilities to have sex. We're talking about sex, love and war. And we're looking at the experiences of young veterans, their time serving and how that has affected their sex lives and relationships. And joining us is Dr. Christopher Fox, who is a psychosexual and relationships therapist, and Chris May, who is a young veteran. Chris, how did coming back from deployment affect your sex life?
It kind of made me, the first time I came back when I was single, I came back and because of the excessive amount of porn that I'd watched, I thought that I myself could, reenact a porn star's lifestyle.
Really?
Which, lo and behold, I could not. So it was one of those things. And then after my second trip, after being wounded when I came back, I was a bit more, I was in a depressed state. I had a head injury, I had a stutter. I just had a really life-threatening experience. So when I came back, I had absolutely no sex drive whatsoever. It wasn't even on the priority of list of things I even wanted to do. The thing that was on my mind that I wanted to do was to go back. And go back out and do my job. Yep. That was the only thing I wanted to do, so I had no sex drive at all.
Yeah. And do you think vets find it harder to talk about the sexual dysfunction or problem side of recovery from war than even physical or mental problems?
Oh, definitely. It's, first and foremost, they won't talk about their feelings, so they're not going to talk about sex, sexual dysfunction in any way, shape or form. But regardless of, soldiers, sailors or airmen, you're in the military, so you're expected to be, a man essentially. So if you were to have any sort of sexual dysfunction, that would make you less of a man and then you wouldn't be any good as a bloke. That's just a common misconception. We can't even get the guys to talk about their feelings and say that they've had a rough day or they're feeling a little bit depressed or upset or they've gone to their local memorial and broken into tears. Like, we can't even get that out of them. So it's... that's definitely a hard conversation to start.
And Dr. Fox, I've read a bit about sexual dysfunction, not just for men when they come back, but for women as well. What are the usual symptoms of that?
Of sexual dysfunction, well, it's the presence of, if we're talking about a physical dysfunction for men, erectile dysfunction, premature ejaculation, or rapid ejaculation, potentially delayed ejaculation. But of course, delayed ejaculation, many people don't pick up on because a guy should be able to last forever and ever and ever. And so delayed ejaculation often gets missed. And for women, it's things such as anorgasmia, inability to orgasm, pain, sexual pain conditions occurring, like vaginismus. So, I mean, there's a number and they're pretty, They're obviously there to the person experiencing them. And of course, the other side that we have to consider is that we'll treat the brain, we'll treat the body. But of course, practitioners are embarrassed to talk about sex. So you've got guys who don't want to talk about sex and practitioners who don't want to talk about sex. And then suddenly we have all these sexual problems around us that aren't being dealt with.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you think, does some of this dysfunction come from, I guess, the inability to make yourself emotionally or physically vulnerable when you get back from war?
For some personnel, I think it would be partly those issues, being just being present in the moment for others. I mean, if we're talking about PTSD and high levels of stress, even that ability just to be is quite hard.
Dr. Fox, I've actually read that it's not uncommon for men to become erect when on the battlefield. Why is that?
Well, I've got Chris here in the studio with me. Chris, what's been your experiences?
We were just talking about in the break a moment ago. It's their nickname, Battle Fats. They're nicknamed Battle Fats. The whole thing is, it can be in training, it can be in anything, and it's just the arousal. It's just being all hyped up. I found that the one that got me, that surprised me the most, was the day that we got into a contact in Afghanistan, and the vehicle I was in was forced to go down and chase a bloke that was escaping from the contact site, a possible Taliban member who was running off, and we chased him down. And when I went out there, the legs started shaking, the adrenaline started running, I was panicking because I was looking out for the enemy, also trying to find this guy that had disappeared. And lo and behold, you know, I was erect, and I had to try and figure out a way to tuck it into my pistol belt, you know, to get out and go and do my job, because my brain was going, what are you doing?
And then I think the easiest way to explain arousal is arousal. You know, I work with people in police force as well, and explain to them that, you know, you're in a highly aroused situation. You know, your body's aroused. These things occur. It's like nurses and medicos in ERs spend all day hyper-aroused responding to crisis situations, and then go home and don't want to experience arousal and therefore, you know, have a lack of desire for sex. And it's like, well, you don't have a lack of desire. You just simply have high levels of arousal. So, you know, I know we often think about sexual arousal as different, but arousal is arousal. It's just being manifested in a different way in the body. So, you know, listening to Chris's story, you know, he was highly aroused in that situation, and one of those effects was an unwanted boner, so to speak.
And so, Chris, was that really confusing for you in the moment?
Not really. In the moment, my priority was being a soldier. It turns out the bloke that we had to, the Taliban fighter, was wounded. So when I got out of the vehicle, my mind was straight back to soldiering, you know, and doing the job of one, securing the site, two, doing first aid on this bloke. And it didn't actually even come to mind. And then later on, we were talking about it, because after that evening, it all went quiet, and I was talking to one of the boys in the section, and I said, oh, just really weird. Like, my leg started shaking and I got a boner. And he's like, oh, did you? He goes, oh, so did I. And I was like, oh, so it wasn't just me then. It's not. And like, literally, we both laughed about it, and that was it. That was the process, mind done. You know, we just thought it was a normal thing, and it happened to two of us out of the four, and so it was normal.
And
that's how we processed it.
Did that affect you at all when you got home in sexual situations, like Dr. Fox was saying? Did you avoid arousal because of that?
Yeah, for the most part. Like, I think for me, the bigger part was, you know, I didn't avoid arousal. I would try and just do whatever I had to do, but the hypervigilance part of coming back and that hyper, you know, security, you couldn't live in that moment, so you couldn't actually get aroused, because instead of focusing on living in the moment and getting aroused and being intimate with your partner, you're actually focusing on, you know, I heard a noise outside. Who's that? Why are they out there? Let's go out and beat them up. They're outside my house in my backyard. That or a car drive past and it backfires, and that puts you off completely.
Mm.
So that was the hard part there. Yeah.
And Dr. Fox, how can veterans get through something like this if they're experiencing sexual dysfunction after war?
One of the things I would encourage anybody experiencing sexual dysfunction is to reach out, whether it's to their GP, to a sexual health physician, a psychologist or a therapist, or hopefully a sex or a psychosexual therapist, somebody who's trained to deal with sexual issues and able to deal with sexual issues. A lot of the work that we do is often dealing with things like trauma, depression, anxiety in our work, yet it's being able to work with people and give them exercises about being in the moment sexually and well, just basically being in the moment sexually.
Chris and Dr. Fox, thank you so much for joining us on The Hookup. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate speaking. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, imagine what it's like having your partner gone for months or even years, and then suddenly they come home from war and you're expected to pick up where you left off. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about what it's like for partners of young vets with PTSD with Dr. Stephanie Hodson, who works with the Department of Veterans Affairs. Dr. Stephanie, how difficult is it for the spouse of veterans when they come home?
Hannah, I'm really pleased we're going to talk a little bit about the other side of the equation. It is tough, and it's tough from the point of view that I've lived both sides of it. I've been the person who got to go, but I've also been the person who's had to sit and wait for the partner to come home. And it's always so exciting. Like, you're dying for them to get home. But the trouble is, you have both changed. They've been away and they've seen amazing stuff, and they've matured in a different way to you. But you've also been home, and especially if there's kids involved, you've become so much more independent. Or even if you're just, I can remember as a young single person, or like newly married, you know, he'd go away for long periods of time and I'd reestablish new friends, I'd get new networks. So as someone comes home, there's a whole period of readjustment because you've both slightly changed. You're slightly different people.
And we've heard from you on the text line 0439 757 555 that says, I'm a young soldier about to deploy for the first time and I'm in a serious relationship. Due to previous relationships where I've been cheated on whilst on training exercises, I worry what my partner may be up to while I'm away for 6 months with minimal contact. What usually is the common scenario for, you know, people who are in relationships and get deployed? Do they often split up or...?
I think it's a real mixture and it's really at where the relationship's at. I've been in a very privileged position of actually talking to lots of young soldiers as they come back from ops and especially slightly older ones where you ask, where does it work? Especially when you realise someone's done a couple of operations or been away on exercise a lot and the relationship works. It's actually about making sure that there are good support networks, both for the partner who's behind you. You've got to actually have a good network of friends to keep you busy, keep you occupied. But one of the things we really recommend people do is actually keep a diary. Both sides keep a diary. So that in that first little bit when the person comes home, what you do is whether it's a photo diary or just a list of key dates and key events, and then it's about that first step when the person comes back about re-establishing a sense of intimacy. You know, you've just got a person, a stranger, walk through the door. They've changed slightly. It's about getting to know each other. I think the best advice for when people first come home, and I learnt this the hard way, is you don't get super excited. You just take it easy because it takes a few days to get used to each other again. And then you, once you've had that chance to tell stories, swap both sides because both people have been doing stuff.
We've just got a text on 0439 757 555. You're talking a little bit about not rushing back into your regular sex life. We got a text that says, when I returned from 6 months in Iraq, my sex life went straight back to how it was before I left, and my partner fell pregnant 2 months after I got back. Great to hear from you, but I can imagine it would be quite overwhelming to, you know, feel pressure and expectation that you need to pick up exactly from where you left.
I think a little bit like some of the discussions earlier tonight, every relationship is completely different. I think the bottom line, if you come back and it's all go, that's fantastic. But if it's not, there's nothing wrong with a bit of romance, a bit of re-getting to know each other, a little bit of a few first date nights as you get back in order to just get that friendship going again. Because what we know is intimacy is the bedrock of a healthy sex relationship for both parties.
Absolutely. Dr. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us on The Hookup. And if
any worries, thanks, Hannah.
Thank you. And if anything that we've been talking about on the show tonight has brought up something for you, you can always call Lifeline on 13 11 14, or you can call the Veterans and Veterans Families Counselling Service, which is a 24-hour service, on 1 800 011 046. Thanks for listening to the podcast. And remember, if there's a topic that you would love us to cover, you can always get in touch. Email thehookup@abc.net.au or send us a message on Facebook.